In the real world, you need to have a reasonable number of ambulatory patients. And if in the presence of those stimuli, they weren't using heroin, and they were working productively and getting into difficulty, now you can make the claim that this, you know, this is a different approach. So I think Vince was right in the sequence in which he proposed it.
In your interview at ACMP, you say that you did the first ambulatory stabilization on methadone.
To the best of my knowledge.
Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, that takes me into Chicago. First of all, up to that time, to get on to the methadone program in New York, you need to be interviewed. And certain people were rejected. They weren't considered acceptable.
On what grounds?
I don't know what grounds. Weren't motivated, too psychopathic, were too unstable. I mean, that's how they sent me this guy that they put on oxymorphone. And then you'd have to agree to spend 6 weeks at Beth Israel. Well, that is a very big, expensive, front-end load for a treatment. And given what a hospital bed cost back then. Since I had already put people on methadone without putting them in the hospital at Einstein, I didn't see any great reason that I had to start doing exactly the way they did it. And so we just developed the technique when we first started this by putting people on a modest dose that I knew would not be lethal, but that would probably suppress withdrawal, given a modest dose, and say, look, this may not hold you, but you'll come back tomorrow, we'll talk again, change the dose, and gradually build people up. Now, was the effect as dramatic as keeping them in the hospital for 6 weeks? No. I mean, they're still tempted by everything. There were still all kinds of things. But from a public health perspective of how can you treat a lot of people, all of whom were demanding treatment, if you had to say, well, I finally got six beds in the hospital and they'll turn over every 6 weeks, you can realize that all you can do under those circumstances is maybe treat, what, 50 people a year? You know, when we started, we had hundreds on the waiting list immediately. Well, to me, well, I won't go into all of it, but, you know, there's a risk, a serious risk of mortality every day you're out there. And there was certainly just not something I was willing to tolerate anyway. And since I knew you didn't need it, at least for the few people I treated, now maybe they were different, maybe they were more upscale, a few were musicians and things, people reasonably stable. But it was worth trying, and that's exactly what we did. So our methadone treatment involved ambulatory stabilization. We used our inpatient unit for people who wanted to detox, and there were lots who didn't want methadone. And, or maybe they wanted it, but we assigned them to detox it. So we detoxified people in a hospital unit. Some were willing to try cyclazine. We did a controlled study again out there. So, you know, were there other people who did ambulatory maintenance? I don't know. We began ours on, you know, I guess it was about the 1st of January, 1968. I still have that prescription downstairs.
Nice.
Well, he was a very special person, and I was very angry because it was our medical school that was treating. This is one of the guys I treated in New York, a musician, called me and told me about this musician friend of his that I should see. A lovely man. Played the clarinet. And you know, What was his problem? Well, he also had Hodgkin's. Mm-hmm. But he was told by the people at our hospital that they would not treat him because he was an addict. And it just made me too angry. Now, we'd been preparing for some time. We were going to start maybe in June of 68. And I said, we're starting today. I had my prescription pad, and we started right from the hospital pharmacy, and that's how it began. And lots of people were angry at me for starting prematurely, but I still had some staff. I said, let's do it. Let's get it going. Mm-hmm. And that's how it began on that day. And this guy did very well. Eventually became a counselor, and after a few years, he left and went off with his wife, who was Dutch, and they lived in the Netherlands. But they treated his Hodgkin's, and he went into full remission.
Hmm. All right, so tell me how you got to Chicago. Tell me the story.
You heard the first half of the story. The first half of the story is I wanted to try. I wrote a grant to put in to compare lamb to methadone to detox, something of that sort. And I couldn't find any place, despite this big hospital, lots of empty space. Nobody would give me anything to do. So I concluded that this was not a place that cared very much whether I got a grant to do lamb or not. So I had this bottle of lamb, and I had this offer to go to Chicago, and I decided to accept. That's how I got it. It was a lag time, and I spent 6 months, still lived in the Bronx, spent 6 months doing a little work at Rockefeller with Vince and Marie, and then that January went off, December of 66 or January of 67, I went to Chicago.
And what did you do with Vince and Marie during that period?
Did various things, tried some things, learned what they did, puttered in the lab. I probably frittered away my time. I didn't do anything useful.
You sort of apprenticed yourself to them, or?
More or less.
At this time, you were kind of moving from being self-identified as a psychopharmacologist, to someone who was specializing in addiction treatment?
That's what happened, yes.
And was it a conscious, or did it just happen?
Was it conscious? It was conscious. I knew what was happening. But I guess the idea of having the knowledge to be helpful to people, mm-hmm. being a physician, and you could essentially say, let somebody else do it, or you could say, I'll do it. And I decided that I'll do it. Now, when I went out to Chicago, I still had this career development award. And they gave me a lab, and I was supposed to continue working in the lab. That was going to pay some of my salary. But in the meantime, I was an advisor to the Illinois State Program. I told them what they should do, and they said, here's the condition. We'll put up this money, and we'll give you the authority, but you have to run it. I thought that was basically a choice between continuing to do research and becoming a clinician administrator. And again, in the process of trying to put some of these things together, you met a lot of people. The musicians that I got to know in New York, a couple of these people that I met in Chicago. And you found that there were some people who, but for their addiction, were people you'd want to have in your house. Nice, you really felt some need to say, there's something unethical about saying I would rather work on my career development award. It was kind of blackmail by the Illinois Drug Abuse Program, in the sense that, yes, this thing, the first year will cost $1 million. That was big money, by the way, back in the 60s. $1 million if you'll run it. And I just felt that, didn't have much of an ethical choice. So I began to do it, and I realized I could not keep the lab going and do all the things that building this program required. So I gave up the Career Development Award, much to the dismay of the people who thought that that would pay my salary at the university. Anyway.
And that was a particular problem for Danny Friedman?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, bringing in grants into the university is what chairmen are supposed to do. I was giving up that kind of grant with overhead just to run this thing for the state, which only provided a little bit of overhead for some things, but it was a different level of prestige, I think.
What was your relationship with him like? How had you met?
He came and gave a talk on LSD in a symposium that I organized at Einstein on the addictions or drugs of abuse and society, something like that, where we had different people talking. I don't really recall who else gave talks then.
And what was he like?
Oh, Danny? Smart, charming. Danny was... There was nobody like him in psychiatry. I mean, he was really... what was he like? He was full of, you know, he was clever, smart, written a textbook. I mean, you had to like Danny. I mean, he was just smarter than everybody.
Mm-hmm. How'd he know what he knew about drugs?
Well, he had done some work on LSD. He had spent some years at NIH working there. He'd worked with Kunin Kornetsky. And he had an interest in it. He had an interest in everything. I mean, Danny was... probably knew everything. I mean, he just basically one of these people. And I think, I'm trying to remember, he had just become editor of the Archives of General Psychiatry, so he read all the manuscripts coming in, but he'd always seemed to know everything.
So, what was the state, had there been any publicly funded treatment in the state of Illinois prior?
Well, it depends on how far back prior you go. There was nominally a civil commitment program, but to the best of my knowledge, nobody was using it.
So Illinois went to civil commitment about the same time that California and New York did?
Oh, let me just hold on just a second. One of my students and my class on drug society and policy can't get to the reading materials. And let me, what is this, public? Just a minute, what did Faith just send down? Excuse me, just a minute. This must be. Oh, God, hold on a second. Let me just.
The state of Illinois.
To the best of my knowledge, there was no treatment. There was one little place which sort of did some group therapy that had a grant from OEO. To the best of my knowledge, everybody said that the only place you could go was to plead guilty to a misdemeanor and go to the Cook County lockup, and yes, a kindly nurse there would give you some tranquilizer.
Yes. There were people in private practice, I assume?
I don't know.
Can you think of any psychiatrists in Chicago who would have had a private practice who would have treated addicts?
Not at that time. Later, some came on board. I don't know of any at that time.
Okay.
There were probably lots of people who treated that.
Danny Friedman would not have, would he?
No.
Did he?
Okay. No, he didn't treat psychiatry. I'm not sure he treated anybody, but he might have. I mean, he was very busy in international affairs and national affairs.
Yes. I ask, let's take a break for a second from the interview. In 1964, a Life magazine photographer named Bill Eppridge took photographs in Needle Park, and Life magazine also dispatched him to Michigan and to Lexington, and he took a stunning series of 1,000 photographs. Mm-hmm. He's still living, and he's interested in exhibiting the photographs, perhaps at MoMA, you know, a really big national exhibition. These photographs, I have them in the car. I have some of them on my laptop. I can show you. They're extraordinary. But at any rate, the two heroin addicts, it was a couple. Do you remember the story at all? It was published in Life, and I can show it to you tomorrow. Basically, he followed them and lived with them for 3 months, photographing them all the while. And at the end of that period of time, they didn't think they could, you know, cop in the city of New York anymore. And so Life airlifted them to Chicago and supposedly set them up. They had been to Lexington several times.
Yep.
And they supposedly set them up with a psychiatrist who was treating drug addicts in Chicago. And this would have been sometime, I think, in 1965. And we're trying to find them because they were pseudonymous and they disappeared. Now we'd like to find what happened to them.
You need to keep in mind, I guess that we probably overstate the case when we say that there was no treatment available. Even in the worst of the Anslinger era, there were always private sanitaria where the people with the means could go get a few shots of morphine and things. We'd heard all about these things at Lexington. People would tell us that, you know, if you know the right people, you know. Now, could there have been private psychiatric hospitals which would take people in and give them, during confinement, gradually withdraw them? I'm sure they were. Could there have been psychiatrists who were willing to get at their unconscious conflicts to help them? I'm sure they were. I mean, psychiatry has never been completely disinterested in treating the addictions. Rado did it, things of this sort. So was there treatment available? I guess if you had the means, somebody would purport to be of use. But the question is, how effective were the methods? Not how sincere was the practitioner, or how well-meaning, but if you look even 20 or 30 years later, that nobody is still convinced that individual psychotherapy can make a difference. Now, I say that even though I have used it successfully, much to my amazement. I have treated people and they got better. And I'm saying, you know, I don't believe this. Because when they come in, they want me to treat them. And I say, look, I'll talk to you. But I don't know of any success with this individual therapy. You know, I tell them all the other things. No, they still want me to treat them. So, fine, let's talk. And it's these exceptions that, you know, lead people astray. So under those, and I've done this several times. I don't exactly know why it happens. It may be that people are really ready to change by the time they come, and things of this sort. But let me put it this way. There are probably always people who would provide something to people of means. But for the street addicts, the hundreds and hundreds of them, I don't think they had access to that. They certainly couldn't get into the hospital even if they had Hodgkin's.
Yeah.
Okay? So, and I'm sure that Cook County didn't do much for them. So, in that sense, you'd have to say, what does it mean to say that they had no treatment? Was it publicly supported? Well, I guess you could try to sign yourself into a state hospital, but I'm not sure the state hospitals were accepting anybody. And I don't know of too many people who ever told me that that's what they had done.
Right.
So my answer is, to the best of my knowledge, people told me there wasn't anything.
Right. So nobody leaps out as an obvious. Okay. So when did you get to Illinois?
Yeah, I got to Illinois in a snowstorm in December of 1967. There was a great, great blizzard in 67 that fell on Chicago and left about 2 feet of snow. And that's when I pulled into town. But I traveled there several times before to consult with the program. This was my first trip to Chicago.
Right. That was to consult with the advisory council, the governor's advisory council?
Yeah.
And, again, why did they come looking for you?
Danny sent them. They didn't come looking for me. They came looking for Danny, and Danny was busy, so he sent me.
And what were they looking for at that point? What did they think they were looking for?
I think they were looking for somebody to tell them whether they would have a therapeutic community, or they would have some people saying methadone, the police were saying, we know what we're doing, just leave it alone, or a big hospital to detox people. I mean, when you have a lot of lawyers and an internist and people getting around the table saying, what should we do? Nobody, you know, there were, you know, the local judge, policeman, head of the narcotics bureau. I mean, these were all the people called together to decide what should we do. I don't know what they really wanted. I guess they wanted to sort of explore what there was to decide what to do.
It does seem awfully rational of them to have decided to call upon your expertise rather than...
What expertise? I was an assistant professor. Come on.
But by that time, surely, you would say that you had amassed some expertise.
They could have called Isbell, they could have called lots of people. They could have called Vin Stoll.
Right, but none of them were going to come out and set up a treatment program.
I wasn't going to set up a treatment program either. I was just supposed to be a consultant. I had a career development award. I had a laboratory. I was going to be an academic psychiatrist. I was consulting.
And so what happened?
I told them that there is no way for you to decide what's good for Illinois. There are these various things. You could have antagonists, you could have opiate maintenance, you could have a therapeutic community, you could have detox, you could, after detox, you could use antagonists. You could have all of these things. What's good for Illinois? I don't know. If I were you, I would set them up and compare them and see what's good for your people. That's what I said. What else is there to say? What could an honest person say at that time? I mean, clearly the big, you know, controversy was, are we going to have methadone? I mean, lots of people didn't like that. The other stuff they didn't know much about, but couldn't see any great objection to, except how to get it done.
Right. Was the methadone issue driving this kind of investigation of theirs? Were they considering methadone? I mean, did...
I don't know. Possibly. But I'm really not sure what they were considering before I got there. Once I put them all on the table, I suppose they were considering all of them. I don't know who I don't know who else they asked in or things of this. But I came out there 3 or 4 times for a day to talk to people. But I knew if you were going to have anything, you had to have indigenous people working in it. You couldn't have, you know, carpetbaggers coming in. So I spent some time, I guess it was called St. Leonard's House on the near west side that had a program. And I went and I met people. One was one of them. One guy's name was Chester, I think. And meeting people, got to know them. I got to know Bruce, Father Bruce, with what was his last name? Bruce Wheeler was running St. Leonard's House. And, you know, they were doing their best they could. There was a place where people could meet, and they knew groups could help. But they didn't have doctors or anything else. And I met a couple of people, and I arranged, when I knew that we had the program, I immediately said, Chester, I want you to go spend 6 months at Daytop. And I called the people at Daytop and I said, please, let him come there and learn. Well, there was this, we're not going to give away our secret methods.
Right.
But they eventually agreed.
Proprietary medicines.
Well, in some ways, there's still people who believe that kind of stuff. Anyway, so this is what I said, this is probably what you should do. I don't know what else to tell you. Not one of these things, you know. Should you only have methadone? I don't think so. There are lots of people who would not want that. Have a detox unit, would that be okay by itself? Probably not. We knew the detox wasn't that great. But maybe you need to have it anyway, just so that nobody says you're forcing something into methadone. And the therapeutic community is fairly selective. Hard to set up, might not work. There's a certain charisma that you need to make those things work. And they don't take in many people. So in terms of a major epidemic, you're not going to make it with a TC. Now, not that I didn't try to persuade Synanon to come, I did. But my interactions with Chuck Diedrich are another story altogether. But the fact is that some of these took place, I think, even before I think we got put up the grant. I went in some ways to explore what would it take to get these things up and running. Anyway, so that's when I got there, and I think, when did they pass the legislation? I think they passed it just as I came.
So you weren't involved in any of the lobbying, none of the structure of the legislation or anything?
Well, not really, but the legislation is around. I have a little book about how they did it, signed by the governor, and Jim Moran became a federal judge. He was the one who actually wrote it. No? If I said I would do it, once I said that, they said, we'll put it in. They apparently, although technically the governor's office is in Springfield, his actual office is right there in downtown Chicago. And so during this entire time, people from the governor's office knew exactly what was going on. So if the governor said, we're going to do this, this is, after all, an executive decision. And there was a guy named Harold Vysotsky, who was head of mental health, very bright, able guy, knew what we were doing. He was on that board as well. I mean, he's a psychiatrist. But again, most psychiatrists didn't have much experience with this stuff.
Yeah.
It might have looked like a lot of money to me, but it was probably peanuts in the budget of a state.
Sure.
So when they said, this is what we want, they really said, that's all you want. there's a certain, you have to understand, I don't know, can't remember how old I was, maybe it was 31, 32, something like that. So that's how it sort of went down. There was a structure that the bill said we were going to compare these things. And I don't know did you ever see that report of the Illinois Drug Abuse Program?
I think we have, yeah. Joe has, yes, showed it to me.
It's a little green folder or something I have someplace in the basement. It said, this is what we're going to do. And so that's how I got to be a clinician.
Yeah, so they finally got you out of the lab and into a laboratory of another kind.
It was sort of a laboratory of another kind. But, you know, starting from scratch with three different things, with virtually nobody trained in any of these things, Yeah. Took a lot of time and a lot of effort.
Well, let me ask you about what you said earlier about you were convinced that any viable effort would require indigenous people. Yeah. How did you become convinced of that?
Really? Well, I'm not sure exactly how. I think if you look at what you recognize, that part of what changes people is a belief that there's hope, mm-hmm. that they can change, that things are possible, that there are people of goodwill willing to help them. Well, what I saw in Dolan Eiswander's program is they were hiring some ex-addicts on methadone to help people, so almost both counselors and exemplars. AA is built around not just self-help, they're exemplars. And this is something that's going on since the Washingtonians. Mm-hmm. You help other people. And in helping other people, you help yourself. And so you needed that sense of, yeah, I knew him from the street. Look what he's doing. I can do it too. That's important. But, you know, if I could have brought doctors in who were well-trained from other places, I would have done that to help them. But the truth is, there weren't that many in the whole country. Yeah. Number two is, neither the state nor the university were paying salaries that would make it attractive enough to bring people into Chicago. Chicago in the mid-1960s was not a place that people who looked like me wanted to be.
At least the South Side.
Yeah.
Where you lived. Yeah. There as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we lived in. Excuse me.
Yes.
I can put together some
importance of sort of indigenous. You call them something? Indigenous workers or indigenous? You had a word for it at IDAP, didn't you?
No, we didn't use any word like that at IDAP. No. We just hired people.
Yeah, okay.
But my view of it was we needed authentic Chicago people.
Yes.
To build the system. And I was saying that we just didn't have what it took to attract people to come in de novo from other who were trained in this. There just weren't any.
Right. And there was a lack of training as well.
There was no training in this area, no yeah. clinical training. And
you had had what amounted to clinical training in this area, hadn't you?
In what sense?
I mean, Lexington?
I was a psychiatrist. I'd seen addicts in an institution. My task was now to build a system that could treat addicts not in an institution.
Yes, yes. Was there debate about closed institutions versus ambulatory treatment at that time? Do you remember that debate?
If there was, I don't remember it. You know, I wouldn't have been taking place in it. I knew that this was 1967. The data from Lexington were already at hand. Keeping people 6 months or a year at Lexington did not preclude a high level of relapse. Mm-hmm. Now, under those circumstances, you can imagine what my response would be to the expense of a closed facility. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, and I don't think it's changed, my view of it is that society views the drug addict as some kind of amalgam between a patient and a miscreant. And they're willing to see him treated, but not as good as any other patient. Mm-hmm. Can't be too expensive. Mm-hmm. So the resources are always limited. And the question for the people who have to deal with those resources is, how can I maximize their impact given the size of the population in need? And as you'll find out later, I looked at how much was being spent on Lexington when they turned it into a clinical facility, and I said, that's not where you put the money.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I'll get back to that, but so I would never have, you know, willingly spent what a closed institution costs. Now, that doesn't mean that at a reasonable price, a residential facility doesn't have its advantages, particularly when you're dealing with people with unstable housing and things of this sort. But it has to be something that a reasonable cost, because a dollar put into that, it could be a dollar put into something else. And you have to say, what's the best allocation? And that's what I was busy doing, you know, for the 5 years at IDAP.
Yes, so when you went IDAP, had you had administrative experience before IDAP?
No.
Or was that really, you were learning that at the same time as you were founding the program? And
yeah. Still don't know what administrative experience means, but
I hope I never know. So what difficulties did you encounter as you were getting IDAP up and running?
I don't think we have the next 3 weeks to talk about that. But the most difficult thing, I suppose, was the conflict between knowing that you need to expand and recognizing that you didn't have enough time to truly train the staff in the procedures. And knowing also at the same time that even a less fully trained staff and that providing some services was probably better than nothing, and that will gradually improve it. That, you know, facts on the ground, a clinic here, a clinic there, a facility there, will build it up. But we got to get it going. We have to have some place to come in out of the cold, even if it's not the Taj Mahal. And that was the critical issue. But it was always a conflict. If you're any kind of a good clinician, you can spot what's wrong. But if you stop to fix it, it means you're not busy doing everything else that needs to be done. Because you need to fix and expand concurrently, and they are almost incompatible. The state was willing to give us more money. Money, I can say, we were running an exceedingly efficient operation compared to anybody else from a cost perspective. Nevertheless, you just can't absorb it and do a decent job, because you're always teetering on the view of scandal could erupt at any time. Because there are always people willing to find some deficit and write it up as if it characterizes the whole thing. And you realize those things. So that was the biggest difficulty. I mean, there obviously were difficulties between the university and the state. Not that there were difficulties, they were very cooperative. But I felt myself in a continuing conflict of interest. Because I was, you know, I could take money out of the state pocket and put it at the university pocket. Kind of, people trusted me. But I just felt that, you know, an awkward situation. This is California. Who wants this? The state did not pay a great deal of overhead, and yet it was getting lots of benefits from the university and the university's activity. How do you compensate a university for the resources that the university is making available? Very difficult to do. Usually it's the overhead mm-hmm. that does that, but the situation didn't provide for that kind of overhead. Anyway, so there were always some tensions, and recruiting was a tension. And anybody who came thought they were coming to the University of Chicago Department of Psychiatry, but if I was paying them on the state, I couldn't say, well, now you can be an academician. Just give me a few hours a week. I mean, that was the kind of scandal that they had at the municipal hospitals in New York. You know, the medical schools would hire people, and they would spend, instead of 35 hours at the city hospitals, they would spend 20 and then work at their academic or other things. These are very tough things to do.
Right, so there were a lot of structural problems.
It couldn't have been done as just simply a state organization. State just doesn't have the attractiveness or the flexibility And it could have been done as a university operation. The university doesn't want to take on that load of clinical responsibility, particularly for neighborhoods that aren't in the immediate vicinity of the university. I mean, we had programs in Rockford, we had programs in Peoria, East St. Louis. Why would a university do that?
Right, right. Now, was there also at what point did you start doing research, or did you always continue doing research? And was there tension between research and clinical?
What kind of research?
Or did you what kind of research did you continue to do?
Well, we tried to do studies of the programs we were setting up.
Sort of evaluation?
Well,
research?
I guess you could call an evaluation. You know, you're reporting on the outcome. Mm-hmm. What happened when you did ambulatory studies? How well did the people do? What happened? We compared dosages. We looked at, we probably should have published more. But, you know, there's just a limit to the energy you can amass in doing this kind of thing. There were some additional people who were doing research, and I was encouraging them to do it. They were at the university. I can't even remember how we paid them at the time, whether we paid from the university. The university finally got a grant from the feds a year later. They put people on that. Pat Hughes did some work on epidemiology that was there. We compared cyclazine with a placebo-controlled study. Bob Schuster was brought out there. I think, can't remember whether it was on the state or the university grant, but he set up his pharmacology lab and we did some work. We finally did the first studies on Lamb. Mm-hmm. So we were doing various things, but after a while, as in any situation where you're going to publish things, you really can't direct people to do things. There has to be a certain kind of, you know, initiative that I really would like to learn this, and they have to have the competence to do it, and you can give them the time and the support from time to time, but you can't lay the thing out with that precision. So Pat did the epidemiology. Like I said, Sine and I did a couple of things on Lamb. Bob Schuster and I did some other things. Some things came out. Mm-hmm. More things could have come out, but again, it was the tension between do we do one more study or do we open one more clinic? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was never a point at which there were not more people who wanted treatment.
Yes, yes. And so for you, the moral divide is such that treatment, in essence, wins out over research. In that kind of situation.
That was my role. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say that. I mean, we did try a waiting list control. I mean, you know, are people really better off with methadone than on a waiting list? We did that fairly early. And when somebody's name came up on the waiting list, I called. I had met the guy. So the waiting list, that was the random assignment. When I called, his brother said, no, he died of an overdose. Never wanted to do another waiting list trial.
Yeah.
I had a fairly good idea that, you know, methadone was effective. And that lives with you for a long time. Was ethical. I couldn't take everybody. What should I do? Take first come, first serve? I didn't even know how to do that. So we said, fine, we'll take them randomly. And so you knew what was happening. You knew that there are really risks associated with this behavior. And if you get them into treatment, you reduce those risks. Mm-hmm. And so each of these programs, the therapeutic community that we set up, the methadone programs, the detox units, we had a program for youth, other things. All of them are tremendously, they seem to take a lot of time. And then from time to time, I had to rewrite my chapters in Goodman and Gilman. I think I had to do that in 1969. Yeah, that took some time. Mm-hmm. It's kind of laborious, so I was doing that at the same time that I was also running things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll want to do a whole thing on Goodman and Gilman, I think, after we...
What's to do?
I want to talk to you about the evolution of that over time and things of that nature. But so you had a therapeutic community, you had a methadone program. About how large was your methadone program at its peak?
I think it must have been somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000. I can't remember, but it was in that range. I mean, it was growing every day, and it depends on what point in time you look at it.
Yeah. Detox, obviously. You said you had a youth program. What any other sort of special population programs?
Well, we even had a program for people. Remember, I told you that some of the counselors were not... You know, you had different philosophies for the counselor. Now, some people, you know... there were some ex-addict counselors, and they were fairly tough. And if people didn't adhere to the rules and continued to use and came up positive, you know, they would discharge them, or they didn't come. I mean, you can't run every clinic yourself, so there's a certain delegation. But then you'd find somebody dropped out. Why? Well, they didn't show up, or this. So we started a program. I don't know if we called it the Loser's Clinic or the Recycle Clinic, but it was called Second Chance. And John Chappell, who's now a professor, you know John Chappell?
I know of his work.
Yeah, he's... anyway, he took that on. And we found that, you know, bring them back in, they do much better the second time. And so, it was, you know, would they, with better... trained, more compassionate people have done just as well the first time? I don't know. Maybe people have to hear, look, there are limits. I don't know. All I know is we started this and they did well again. Did we have I don't know if we developed a program for pregnant women or not. I know we had some.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about women.
Was there
anything specific to women, or did they get mixed in?
Mostly they got mixed in, but when we started Tinley Park, women could move in with their children. You know, they talk about a whole, takes a village. Well, they got a lot of adults and a smaller number of children, but the children were now surrounded by non-doped out adults. So they really were never cared for quite as well. So that was Tinley. And there were people in methadone who weren't doing well because they were drinking or something else. They could move in. So Tinley was very tolerant. It was, if you will, a therapeutic community that accepted people on methadone. Mm-hmm. And if you only wanted to stay 2 weeks, that was okay. If you wanted to stay 3 months, even better. It was a very unusual place. And we did detox there, too.
At Tinley.
Oh, yeah. Oh. A psychiatrist named John Lowney lived down that way, came over, we had a nurse come, gave out medication. I had to give out medication for people on methadone anyway. Mm-hmm. So he could detox people there. It didn't require a lot. Everybody watched him. Look, if Synanon and therapeutic communities could detox people on the couch with no medical support at all, and they'd already demonstrated by that time that you could do alcohol withdrawal on an outpatient basis with only vitamins. I mean, remember, we're talking about 1969.
Right.
If you could do all of that, and you knew that, why did you have to have a $1,000 a day hospital bed to do what could be done as an outpatient? So Tinley Park had the bed, it had the structure, it provided food, and it had a psychiatrist and a nurse, and we did all of that.
What was the inspiration for Tinley Park? I mean, how did it come about?
I looked at the results of our University of Chicago detox unit and what we were paying for it. And I said, if I had a residential facility, not part of a hospital with all of its overhead and x-rays, we could treat a lot more people with the same resources. And it so happened that there was a staff building on the grounds of a state mental hospital in Tinley Park. Mm-hmm. It was one of the newer hospitals, but they no longer provided housing for the staff. They used to keep the aides and things of that sort there in the hospital, so an empty building. And since I was part of the Department of Mental Health, there was no sweat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Harold Visotsky made things happen. He was the head of the Department of Mental Health. So you had all kinds of people sort of working to help you get things done. And we set up Tinley Park.
So it was not a closed institution.
No, you could leave. It was pretty much like any therapeutic community. Mm-hmm. You're here because you want to be here. Mm-hmm. If you want to leave, let us know tomorrow morning. You know, it's hard to leave Tinley Park because of where it's located in Tinley Park. I mean, there's probably a bus if you want to go there, but if you wait, there's a shuttle. Next morning, we'll let you leave. And nobody was compelled to stay. Mm-hmm. No absolute period you could quit. It was pretty much, you know, voluntary stuff. Tinley Park had some nice grounds, and I remember we had some nice picnics down there for the whole staff. So we had people from our therapeutic communities, people from our methadone programs, people from the detox unit, the abstinence group, all came down, played volleyball, had food. There was a certain sense of camaraderie and not rivalry.
Within IDAP?
Yeah.
In general?
Right. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to replicate bits of Tinley Park when the Salvation Army gave up its big building on the south side. We were able to acquire that and set up something called Safari House. And it had residential beds, had methadone, it had detox, it had outpatients, had vocational stuff, right there on the south side. And it was run by a couple of guys who'd gone through the detox unit, were doing well.
So the multimodality language was yours?
I don't know if it was mine. I guess I made it up, but I'm sure other people had used multimodality before that. I don't claim originality for it, but that's what we said.
And by the time IDAP was something like 15 sites, by the time, sort of at its peak?
I don't know when it was on its peak. I don't know, you know, after I left.
Yeah.
I was very busy. I didn't try to keep track of IDAP.
Right, right.
I think it must have had at least 8 or 9 by the time I left.
Uh-huh, okay.
I know we had 1, 2, 3, you know, probably about 9 sites.
Yeah, yeah.
By the time I left.
So, tell me, I want to now talk a little bit about, in particular, Bob Schuster, and then the EPI sort of cluster, Patrick Hughes and Noel Barker and Gail Crawford and those folks. So it seemed to me like, at that point, you were deciding, well, okay, we're going to look at behavioral approaches, we're going to look at epidemiological approaches. Those both seemed fresh at the time. So can you tell me what you thought you were doing going in those directions in particular? Because it seemed like you really invested in those directions.
Well, there was a paper that I think was published about the same time. Was it Rathod and somebody else whose name will come to me, called The Spread of Heroin Addiction in Crawley, Newtown.
Oh, sure. I know that study. Yeah, it's a strange name. Doesn't stick in my mind.
Yeah.
D-E...
D-Lacan. D-Lacan.
Yes.
Yes. Now, what you saw was the heroin came in, and then it spread from group to group. And part of the idea was, if we could identify a beginning epidemic, maybe we could get in and treat it and abort the epidemic. So basically, the hypothesis was maybe there are mini epidemics. Somebody's bringing in some dope and it's spreading. So first, where are the epidemics? Where are the users living? Are they clustered? Are they diffuse? what's the nature of how they interact? And Pat wanted to do that. I said, fine, go do it.
Why do you want to do it? So you had already hired him.
Yeah, because he was wanted to do epidemiology, but he was also a physician. I mean, I needed to build depth in terms of doctors who are willing to work in this system. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, it's the kind of system where you, if you don't have redundancy, you are at great risk.
Yeah.
I mean, and so his price was, you know, support for his epidemiological interest, and that was fine with me. And he knew something about it because he'd been at, wasn't NIDA then, it was down NIMH, the narcotic group.
Right, DNADA?
Whatever.
NIMH, DNADA. And so he knew about that paper, the crawling information?
No, I don't think so. But he was interested in epidemiology.
Right. And you had read the paper.
Yeah.
And you somehow put it together that.
Well, I had read it probably as part of writing chapters for Goodman and Gilman. Mm-hmm. I think it was published in the British Journal of Addiction or something like that. I mean, I knew I'd come across it. And so the idea of intervening in an epidemic, you first have to spot where it is, how to see it. I guess everybody goes back to the Broadway pump.
Yeah. Right.
So he undertook most of those things. He did want to write about, he thought it was worth writing up that we put a detox unit in the university. I don't think there was much to that, but he wanted to write it up, write that up. I mean, he'd like to do that, so it was fine with me. I mean, it didn't contribute directly to evaluating the impact of what we were doing, but it wasn't so far afield that I had to feel that I would have difficulty justifying it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing we were trying to do, of course, in a very primitive way before the equipment really allowed, is how can we use computers to keep track of everything we were doing?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you had to depend on charts handwritten the way a lot of people did, you just couldn't do it with the staffing levels that we had.
Right, so in addition to what I said about the behavioral approaches and the epidemiological approaches, there's also an investment in the use of new technologies,
yeah.
Also with the urine testing as well.
Yeah, we built our own urine testing lab. Mm-hmm. It was basically using Vince Dole's techniques, but nevertheless, you didn't have much alternative. There didn't exist the commercial options that you have now.
Yes, yes. So you had seen the gas chromatography, the thin.
We had been using thin layer.
Yeah, thin layer, right.
That was even when I was at Einstein. So I used the lab that they gave me for my research grant to set up the urine testing lab.
And at the time, were there any concerns or thinking about civil rights issues with urine testing?
Why?
No, there was nothing in the air.
It was a clinical test.
Right.
I mean, I would have not thought, if you were testing a diabetic's urine for sugar, would there be a clinical issue?
Right.
No, there was nothing in the air about testing.
Yes.
Okay.
And at what point was there concern about methadone as a genocidal agent? Had you heard that before you got to Chicago? And
sure.
And was it also in Chicago?
A little bit.
But less than in New York?
A little less, I think.
You also in Illinois ran into less or no division between TCs and methadone? There weren't those sort of divisions?
I started that TC. For a while, I signed the note on the property. I hired the people, you know, and the answer is, if there was any tension, they were smart enough not to let it come to my attention.
Yes. So why do you suppose? I mean, what makes the difference between Illinois and New York, right? In New York, even then, there were entrenched divisions, right?
I think it might have been the size of the egos of some of the people running the programs.
In New York. Yeah, yeah. So that self-aggrandizement,
yeah,
really...
We didn't have anybody of that stature running our therapeutic community that was independent. I mean, basically, it's like, you know, I owned the budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to criticize methadone, you were criticizing the person who was giving you your budget. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody would do that. Furthermore, we brought methadone people into the therapeutic community so they could see how group therapy worked. And we put people from the therapeutic community, come see how methadone program works.
So you sort of intermixed...
Absolutely.
The modalities, and that helped to...
And I brought the people from the therapeutic community to our clinical staff meetings, mm-hmm. and they sat next to people who were running methadone programs and things, and we talked about what we had to do together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So those kinds of divisions and conflicts did not arise during your tenure at IDEP.
Not that I ever detected. There were some friendly rivalries. I mean, you know, basically, John Chappell and I guess maybe Matt and Jeannie Pete, some people I brought out, were always kind of pleased that they had this safari house going that wasn't using methadone and how well it was going and things of this sort. But it was more friendly. It was never one of, you know, anything, because, you know, last year, by the way, I gave John the Marie Niswander Award for doing methadone. And he ran a methadone clinic when he, you know, went to Reno. So John knew how to do those things. And you know, his heart inclines to detox and drug-free because, you know, he's also very big in AA and things. So he's sort of has sort of a background in, missionary medicine as well for a while before he went into psychiatry. So there's a certain aspect to it. But never one of you know, trying to demean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in the therapeutic communities, at least back then before they became much, much bigger, saw themselves as part of IDEP. Although I structured it. See, one of the problems that you have, there were several programs like that. Brass Foundation was another group. One of the problems that you deal with when you're running a state clinic is how do they accept, if they can raise money in contributions, is that a charitable donation? People don't give to the state, but they give to foundations. So if you set up the Gateway Foundation, they can have a board of directors, they get a businessman, the businessman's son needs to move in, he's grateful, he gets his businessman friends to give some money, to give it a car, a vehicle, this, that. It's a way to amplify the resources available. It's also a way to make people just feel just a little bit, give them more initiative. They're not just dependent on the state, they don't become dependent, so to speak. You know, I'll spend whatever you give me the check this month.
Yes, right. So it's an entrepreneurial.
You give them an initiative to go out and do things, and that was important. But the bulk of their money, perhaps even today, I don't know, comes from the state. But they're also independent enough they can raise money, have a board of directors, do things, and we even set up a methadone foundation that could create independent programs. They could find ways to get their own grants, they could do this, they could do that, you know, because you didn't want people to always be exactly state employees. Mm-hmm. There are limits to what a state employee can do, can get, is allowed to do, and you recognize that there are advantages to being semi-independent. Mm-hmm. And so Brass was became an independent methadone provider.
Is Brass an acronym?
Yes.
For
behavioral, well, actually, I won't. It's a very complicated story about Brass, but behavioral research and something, and I don't even remember anymore. But it was there was a time when the therapeutic community was run by the person I hired. Turned out to be a little bit more of a sociopath than I thought. I had sent some people there, people that were close to me, because they needed it. And I got some stories back that told me, this is bad news. Mm-hmm. We need change. And there was corruption at the top. I told the board of directors, we have to make a change. They said, no, we like them. I mean, they were very strange things. So I said, fine, you keep them. But I set up Brass Foundation. I said, we're setting up a new therapeutic community. They're going to get all the money. And it was the last week of the month before the checks had to be written, and they decided, I had already set up Brass, had a new group, brought in some new people to start. And then the board of directors decided, maybe he's right. They amalgamated. I didn't need the Brass structure anymore, the not-for-profit group, because Gateway now had decent leadership. And the guy who had in Gateway, by the way, who was the deputy who came out to head Brass.
And who was that?
Oh, God. Shouldn't have asked.
I'm sorry.
Crockett was the guy who came out initially, and the guy who came out with him was an 18-year-old guy whose name will come to me shortly. And when Carl left, he just took over, and he then got himself an MBA and things of this sort, and he's running a major, major multi-state treatment operation.
We are pasta ready.
Yeah. Faith, yeah. You remember the name of the young man who was heading up Gateway Foundation? Remember they gave me that award and things of the sort? Blocking on his name for the moment.
I'm blocking on everybody's name.
Well, it'll come to me.
Believe me, you're doing better than many people.
It will come. But at any rate, so he gradually took that over. But so Brass was an empty shell. Mm-hmm. It was named, you know, basically people accused me of having Brass apparatus because I was willing to play this game with them. We deliberately said, look, we're going to play a game. I'm going to win. I had the checks. I had to get rid of, I could not tolerate a corrupt, I mean, this guy was hitting on all the young ladies in there and things of this. Mm-hmm. Could not be tolerated. But I had to convince the board of directors to do this, and Bruce Wheeler, and this is a very, you know, nice people on the board. They just couldn't believe they'd been conned.
Yeah. It's hard to admit that one has.
So, it was all quiet. Nobody ever knew. I'm not sure I'm going to let you write all this down, but the point is, I have it on tape. Because when I told them. Anyway. Essentially, then, when we needed another methadone program, we decided, let's use the shell. We'll give it a grant, let it start, and then they will be in the business of being able both to charge fees for some people, to get insurance, to do all kinds of things that we can't do. And Brass is still in Chicago operating.
Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, that's where that thing comes from. It was an empty shell, but the shell was meant to be to persuade a group of people that they needed some leadership change in what is now Gateway Foundation. Yes.
We should go, so she...
What?
I'm all